You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Today we sat down with Alex from Cosmic Skeptic. Best known for his atheism and veganism videos, he's a young philosopher from Britain, so we spoke to him about veganism from an ethicist point of view. Hope you enjoy the conversation.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us, my man.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. And the dog has immediately made an appearance.
She's right here, slightly out of frame for me. But I've seen a lot of your videos on veganism. They have, I don't know if they front ran, but they've certainly reinforced me. And I've been a pescatarian for many years now, I guess 3 or 4 years. And I lose track of why sometimes. And I often will come back to your videos and be like, okay, this is why I'm doing this, because I do live in a world surrounded by friends and family that don't necessarily get it. So the first question that I have is about pescatarianism. And I haven't seen it on your channel, if you've covered it, but I'm curious how it fits into veganism. I know that you're full vegan. Why do you include fish? Why might I need to include fish? And does that also extend to mollusks and snails and crickets and things that we might consider of as the lower capability animal species?
Yeah, so we're really jumping right in.
Yeah, let's get into it, man. Our audience is familiar with veganism, just so you know. We've talked about it at length. So this is why I wanted to dive right in.
That's good. I mean, it doesn't require much introduction usually. Mm-hmm. Although it does need to be clarified, I think, that people... at least ostensibly are vegan for different reasons, right? Some people say that they're vegan for the environment. Some are ethical. Some do it for their diet. I look at this from a philosophical perspective, from an ethical perspective. I'm a vegan because of the fact that I think we shouldn't be causing unnecessary suffering to animals. So this is the key thing to note when we have any of these kinds of discussions, is that ethical veganism is about a minimization of suffering. So your question about which animals we should kind of include in our moral circle of consideration will depend solely on this question of sentience. Sentience being defined here as a capacity for feeling pain, right? Mm-hmm. So it's generally considered, I think, that, you know, certainly sea life like oysters and things pretty much can't feel pain. And I would say that if it's the case that they genuinely aren't sentient, that they can't feel pain, then I don't see any ethical qualm with eating them, right? I'd see them as having the same level of consciousness as some kind of rock or something. If they can't feel suffering, it's not a problem to harm them because of the fact that it's impossible to harm something that can't be harmed if it can't suffer, right? Mm. My position is that because, you know, there can be some gray areas here. It's not always entirely clear where that line of sentience needs to be drawn. It's not clear whether the sentience is something that's kind of like a circuit that's either on or off. It kind of switches on at some point in the evolutionary picture, or if it's more of a gradation. Not entirely clear. So what I like to do is give these animals the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. Right? If I'm in a position where I can choose between eating an animal that may or may not feel pain versus, you know, eating a plant-based diet as I currently do that isn't going to inflict the same amount of suffering, then I'll try to choose that which I have confidence will minimize the suffering. Right? It's kind of like being in a situation where you've got a sentient creature. It's got a 50% chance of being inside this cardboard box, and you've got to choose whether you want to stab the box or not. Mm-hmm. And if the only thing you're going to get from stabbing that box is that you get to eat a nice meal or something, most people wouldn't want to stab the box. So it's not entirely clear where the line is drawn, but I think that we can say that, most evidence seems to suggest that fish have a level of cognition that we would like to, correlate with sentience. Sentience is it's an impossible thing to actually identify within an individual, because by definition, it's a subjective experience. Mm-hmm. All we can look for are indicators that other animals share similar kind of demonstrable capacities to us, things like intelligence, things like sociability, things like reacting to stimuli, this kind of thing. We can't prove that they actually feel pain, but I can't prove that you feel pain.
Sure.
I can only prove that you react in the same way that I react to stimuli. And with fish, we show that fish are social creatures. They can remember who to trust and who not to. They remember kind of which fish have been cooperative in the past, things like this. They have memories beyond the kind of myth that they don't. Which would imply that they have at least some level of cognition that I would like to correlate with suffering, especially given that they try to avoid situations in which other animals, we would unanimously agree they're feeling suffering. Mm-hmm. Fish try to avoid those situations as well. So I think there's good evidence that they feel pain. But that's the key question here, is that if we have an opportunity to minimize the amount of suffering that we're responsible for, that's what we should do. And veganism isn't just about kind of animal suffering. It's not like this thing that exists in isolation. It's just a natural extension of this general philosophy of minimizing suffering. That includes human suffering too. It's just a natural extension of what most people already agree upon, which is that if we don't have to be responsible for suffering, we should abstain from it.
So I don't know if you've ever seen this study, but I had a similar thought process as you when we were talking, what should our diet be? Basically, when we decided we were going to stray from the diet that we'd just grown up with. And one interesting thing I found was that there was a study that showed that fish, when you will poke them, let's say, they move in a reactionary way, but it doesn't light up the brain that's in their head. Much like if you poke a Venus flytrap, it might close. And I'm curious if that is the case, that they don't register it in their brain, like even if you were to poke them with a needle, let's say, that there's just something automated in their skin that says, when you get the sensation, withdraw from it, but they don't register it. Would that change your opinion?
Well, absolutely. And this is the useful thing about philosophy, is that we can talk in conditionals like this. Mm-hmm. You know, if this were the case, would this be the case? And a lot of vegans don't like to talk in these terms. Somebody says, you know, if a cow couldn't feel pain, would you be okay with killing it? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, what are you talking about? Of course they can, right? As a philosopher, very easily just say, well, yeah, if they can't feel pain, then it's not a problem. So I think that, you know, if it is the case that when you, you know, prod a fish and they react, there's genuinely no kind of conscious experience happening there, then I don't think it would be a problem to do so. The issue that we need to be aware of is who has the burden of proof here, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think it shouldn't be a case of us kind of potentially harming an animal and then saying, well, look, I'm going to keep doing this until you can prove to me that what I'm doing is not actually harming them. Mm-hmm. I think it should be the other way around. I think it should be, you are not allowed to harm that animal until you prove unequivocally that it's not causing it suffering. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that's the way the proof should be around. So, you know, people like to kind of cite studies that point in different directions, but we need to understand that consciousness is an impossible thing to understand. I mean, most people can't even agree on a definition of consciousness and sentience, let alone kind of attributing it to various animals. I think that in the case of a fish, it's more difficult for us to kind of get on board with the idea that they feel pain because of the fact that they don't have the same kind of outward emotive responses that other animals do. But that isn't what we should be judging it on, right? We shouldn't care about a dog more than a fish because of the fact that, you know, a dog whimpers and a fish doesn't. Mm-hmm. It should be about the level of cognition, the level of sentience. And these might not necessarily track each other. It might be that, like, a more intelligent creature is actually less capable of suffering, or the suffering kind of subjectively feels like less. In fact, that might be a kind of good line of argumentation. In fact, we might think that other animals being less intelligent beings, I mean, human beings artificially jumped to the top of the food chain because of our intelligence, right? Whereas other animals kind of not having that cognition might be more reliant on their kind of sensory data, their immediate sensory data, the more sensory creatures. Nobody denies, for instance, that dogs experience smell much more acutely than we do in a way that we couldn't possibly imagine. There's no reason to suggest the same thing couldn't be true of something like pain. These animals could actually feel pain in a far more acute way or manner than we could possibly imagine because they're more sensory creatures, even though they have a lesser cognitive ability. So it's entirely unclear. If anybody claims that they've settled the issue on this, then they're probably being funded by someone, or they probably don't know what they're talking about. And until we have some clarity on the issue, I think we should do our best to avoid the suffering. And this assumes that the only reason we shouldn't be eating fish is because of the direct impact on the fish. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's also the disastrous environmental impact of the fishing industry, bearing in mind that the first victims of any environmental crisis are always going to be non-human animals. So it's not just about the direct effect of the fishing industry. Around about a half of all of the plastic in the Great Pacific garbage patch is fishing nets. Fishing nets, right? Like, the fishing industry is terrible for the environment as well. So it's not just about the direct impact on the fish. Mm-hmm. It's also about the effect of the fishing industry as a whole.
I have zooming out a second, because there's two questions, I guess two directions that I'm being pulled towards, but I should, I think, go to the broader question, which is, I'm totally on board for suffering as one of the core metrics that we make ethical decisions by, but it also seems insufficient, which is to say, if the question arises of, can I kill someone in the night in a way that makes them not suffer if they have no family and their family wouldn't suffer? And I haven't been able to really codify and put into language what it is that makes life, or at least let's just keep it to human life and other sorts of species of animals that we deem important, unable to be killed even in a way that is painless to them that doesn't cause suffering. What gets added into that?
Can I give a concrete example?
Sure.
So let's say there's I don't know how big a pack of deer is, but let's say there's six deer that's their family, right? So if you kill one, the other five will be sad. But what Charlie's saying is he thinks it's unethical to sneak up in the middle of the night with six humans and in a coordinated throat slit, you get all six. There's no suffering, right? Still seems like you wouldn't do it to dogs, so you might not want to do it to deer, but it extends beyond suffering. So it becomes more than just that metric.
You'd be surprised what people are willing to do to dogs. I made a video recently about why I eat dogs and dog meat, and it was essentially a parody of kind of meat eating arguments. And I got a lot of hate mail from people who genuinely thought that I was someone who ate dogs. And it's quite funny to see these preachy, annoying, you know, how do you know if someone doesn't eat dogs? Don't worry, they'll tell you. It was very entertaining. To answer your question, the point that I like to stress is that I don't try to make an argument for veganism that's based upon kind of base ethical principles. And we can talk about them if we like. Mm-hmm. But my usual approach is to make an argument from consistency, which is just to say, I want to show that what you already believe is probably consistent with the ethical vegan worldview. So if you're somebody who thinks, I suppose the correct answer to the question of whether or not it's okay is that it's as okay as it would be, for instance, to do it to dogs or, you know, potentially to do it to humans, right? If you had genuinely isolated humans, you're welcome to say that suffering is a necessary but not sufficient condition of moral worth, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I killed a bunch of humans, even if they didn't feel any pain, there'd be something wrong with that. I think that would equally commit you to the view that it would be wrong to do it to a deer. Yep. However, you know, if you think that it's actually okay to kill a deer painlessly, then you might be committed to the view that it's actually okay to kill a human being painlessly, or at the very least, that it's not bad for the human. And that's something I would assert. I would assert that as far as concerns the actual person being killed, if someone's killed painlessly and immediately die, it can't be bad for them to be dead, right? It can't be bad for you to be dead. That doesn't make any sense. We can only talk in terms of it being bad for other people, for society or something like that. And we can talk about it being bad in terms of the character of the person who does it. So you could say it makes you a bad person if you're the kind of person who would do that. That would be like a virtue ethics perspective. Mm-hmm. Ethics is based in the virtues that a person holds and how they act towards others and things like this. But I think that if you are someone who thinks that the only thing that matters is suffering, then you can invent these kind of convoluted thought experiments in which you can kind of do something that seems immoral, but in fact would be ethically permissible. But they're so kind of ethically far-fetched that biting that bullet and accepting that as just a kind of unhappy consequence of your view is easier than accepting the kind of unhappy consequences of competing ethical theories, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, actually, the direction that I go with it is not necessarily to justify any sort of meat eating. It's to question beyond suffering, because as I investigate what I see as suffering, it's, does this thing move and make sounds similar to me, right? So if you yelp, I will assume that you're suffering. And I think I notice even with lobsters, when I was a young boy, somebody boiled a lobster and it was the sound of the air leaving. And I thought it was screaming. And that affected me much more than if I understood, oh no, it wasn't screaming. So I recognize that even my perspective on suffering is so limited and so narrow to what matching my own experience of suffering. The reason that I asked that particular question is because I'm not an antinatalist or anything, but then I then wonder if there is something precious about life uninterrupted, right? Such that I couldn't kill a human being in its sleep painlessly. What ethical considerations do I need to give to plants or grass? And I know it can go crazy as we go down that route. And then how does one interact in a world that requires me seemingly to kill in order to continue?
Yeah, I was going to ask this. What happens when we figure out that plants have consciousness and they experience pain?
My sense is that consciousness, my personal sense is that consciousness exists on a spectrum. And, mm-hmm. you know, at some point I draw an arbitrary line. I'm curious what you think about this.
I mean, this one's actually incredibly easy. Mm-hmm. The question of kind of plant sentience, which mm-hmm. most people kind of bring up in a frivolous manner, but mm-hmm. I can, you know, it can also be brought up very seriously. You know, mm-hmm. what do we do if we find out that, you know, plants are capable of suffering, plants have consciousness? The answer is still to eat the plants. I'll tell you why. it takes more plants to feed livestock than it takes to feed human beings, right? We're already growing enough crops to feed the world population three times over, but we're sending those crops to feed livestock. The majority of the crops that we grow, the plants that we grow, are being fed to livestock. So no vegan should be under the illusion that they are not responsible for any animal suffering. Of course we are. Everybody is. You know, you step on insects when you exit your house. Mm-hmm. You to grow crops and plants, you need to destroy habitats and kind of flatten ground and stuff like this. So you're going to be responsible for animal suffering. It's about minimizing that suffering. So mm-hmm. if plants can feel pain, then we've got two options. We either grow those plants and eat those plants, causing some plant suffering. Or we grow even more plants to then cause those plants suffering so we can feed those plants to livestock so we can then cause the livestock to suffer and kill the livestock to then eat the meat, right? Like we would still actually minimize the amount of suffering we're responsible for by eating the plants directly. Now, I agree with you. This would be a really, really difficult ethical problem if it were more like we had to choose between killing animals and killing plants if mm-hmm. plants could feel pain. I still think we'd err on the side of killing the plants because I think we'd agree that they at least have less sentience. Mm-hmm. But even if they had, even if we discovered that plants were more capable of suffering than any other animal that we have, like plants are actually the most sensitive things that exist, the way to minimize the suffering we'd be responsible for would be to eat them directly still, mm-hmm. rather than grow more, feed them to animals, kill the animals, and eat the plants by proxy.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested and you can kind of see, and I think like you, my diet emerged out of broader ethical concerns, like in an attempt to be consistent with axioms that I hold about what is good and bad. And I think also just a personal psychological attempt to be a good person, et cetera. Mm. So I'm curious, and I've kind of come to the same place that you just described, which is life might be such that in 2020, it is impossible to not do harm, that the direct and second order consequences of being a human on the planet, even with the best attempt, is the suffering or the elimination of life of other sorts of things. And so I guess my question is then, what does it take to be a good person in that world? Is it a wholehearted attempt to minimize suffering? Is there some sort of standard that one needs to live up to? And similarly, at what point can we say someone is a bad person, that they've just thrown out ethical concern or maybe are good and bad antiquated ideas that don't really fit and I'm just being overly moralistic?
I'm afraid I lost a bit of the question there due to an internet connection. I missed just the beginning, but sure. I think were you essentially asking about how, we kind of, by necessity of existing, mm-hmm. we're going to be causing some form of suffering. Yeah. And there's a question of like how much suffering we should be allowed to be responsible for.
Yes. I guess I want, part of what motivates me is a selfish desire to be good. And that is my own psychological foible, mm-hmm. probably of being raised and being told to be a good boy. Right. So that is not even as pure a desire as genuine goodness, but I want to fall into the good category. And I presume many people do. So understanding that living will create what we would consider evil in the sense that, you're causing suffering, but it seems almost inevitable. Can people be then divided into groups of good and bad or less good and bad? How do we consider that? Or are these moral figures antiquated ideas of a world where one could be perfectly good and perfectly evil? And actually, life is much more complicated than that.
Mm. Well, of course, life is famously very complicated, but there are a few things that we need to tease out. Like, we have to be careful throwing around the word evil, for instance. Mm-hmm. You said, everyone's going to be responsible for what we would call evil, that is causing suffering. I don't think we call it evil when someone necessarily causes suffering. When someone causes suffering that they can't help, I don't think you'd call it evil, right? Trivially, somebody could accidentally cause some suffering. I could fall into somebody and push them into the road. I don't think you call me evil for doing so. Clearly, evil has a more kind of motivated connotation. It has to have kind of intention behind it. Mm-hmm. You also bring up the interesting question of whether there can actually be such thing as a truly altruistic act, right? An act that is truly only for the benefit of other people. You say that, I want to be a good person. I do this thing out of a selfish desire to be good. You might actually be more connected to a theory that thinks, suffering and pleasure is the basis of ethics than you think, because what you're essentially saying there is that, yes, I like to do what's good. That's the thing. Like, I like to do what's good. I do it because I like it, because it does something for me. Because how do we define what a good person is, generally speaking? It's the kind of person who, if they run into a burning building to save a child, right? and they come out and everyone's calling them a hero and they say, no, I had to do it. I had to, I couldn't not, right? And people say, wow, that's such a good thing. That makes you such a good person. But what are they saying there? They're saying, oh, I did this for my sake, right? Because, you know, I would have suffered if I let that baby burn in the burning room. So yeah, I had to run in there because, you know, I couldn't not. That's just an admission of you saying that you're doing it for your own sake, right? Mm-hmm. But we think that that's what makes someone really, really good, right? So I don't think it's quite as kind of simple as people often think it is. But yeah, I think to answer the kind of the second implication of the question here, which is that we're always responsible for suffering, the kind of vegan philosophy here, the ethical vegan philosophy here, is that we should minimize unnecessary suffering to the highest degree that we can. Now, of course, it's very difficult to define strictly what is necessary and what's unnecessary. But again, we're kind of dealing with an issue of blurred lines. As applies to the vegan conversation, I might say I'm not entirely sure how much suffering is actually necessary to avoid to be a good person. But I know that avoiding forcing a pig into a gas chamber is definitely on one side of the fence, right? I'm not sure exactly where the line is, but we can say that there are certain things that we should definitely be avoiding. I think the best way to look at it is probably from an individual act-based perspective. In any action you're taking, try to choose the course of action that will require the least amount of suffering. Mm. And what that means, that instead of now thinking of it in terms of, let's kind of tally up all of the suffering that someone's responsible for all of their life, and if it goes over a certain barrier, they're now evil, they're on the bad side. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be like that. It should be like, as long as that person in a majority of situations chose the kind of course of action available to them that caused the least amount of suffering that they could, you know, then I think that that's probably a good way of defining what a good person is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I guess, and this, I'm 100% on board, and I'm not going to go back to eating meat. I was a philosophy major, and I'm interested in the edge cases. You know, that's just what fascinates me about these sorts of conversations.
Yeah.
So I think about that box that you just described, and I think about putting a bunch of plants into it. And maybe it's not 50%, but maybe it's a 1% chance that there's some sort of sentience in these plants. And then I think, okay, I could have a full plate of spinach or a half plate, and I could live on starvation rations. And then there's two forms of my life, one where I cause twice as much suffering to plants around me, and one where I eat the bare minimum. It seems to me, and again, I'm not using this to justify any sort of purchasing from slaughterhouses. I'm very much on, like, this one is clearly on the other side. I am noticing in my life that I'm judgmental, I guess is what I'm saying, like good, bad. And it seems to me that as I really get into the nitty gritty, it needs to be something that is transcended, because it is almost an impossible game. And I don't know what is on the other side of good and bad. And I definitely will try to stay to the one side of slaughterhouses and purchasing from them. But I just recognize that, oh, wow, you could have a plant eater that's twice as bad as another plant eater starves himself.
You got to go for calorically dense nuts, because one nut is like 30 pieces of spinach.
Yeah.
So if you're eating a salad and I'm eating nuts, you're 30 times as evil as I am. Think about it.
Yeah. I would actually just probably accept your premise that we do need to basically abandon this idea that we can kind of cumulatively look at someone's life and say, well, they're a bad person. It's never that simple, right? The idea of kind of just categorizing people into good and bad, it doesn't really work like that, right? Good and bad are essentially relative concepts when applied to kind of the way someone lives their life. Nobody is morally perfect, mm-hmm. as it were. And so kind of goodness and badness as applies to a person is always going to be, you know, like relative. I'm not saying goodness and badness as concepts are relative. I'm not advocating moral relativism here. I'm just saying that, you know, whether or not someone fits the bill will be kind of determined by their culture. You know, a lot of people think that Thomas Jefferson was a good person relative to his time period, but the man was a slave owner and a racist, right? Like things that we would consider to be inexcusably you know, morally blind today. It's obviously kind of a relative judgment. But I think rather than arguing over whether someone like Thomas Jefferson was a good or a bad person, we should argue about the goodness and badness of particular acts, right? Because this kind of conversation doesn't really hold any relevance. I mean, what does it actually matter for a discussion of ethics, whether a person is good or bad? What we should be interested in is the actions we can take to kind of live a good life or continue kind of reducing suffering or whatever it may be. We shouldn't be so interested in kind of labeling people as good and bad.
I agree.
That comes from an atheist perspective, for sure.
yeah. And we're on the same page.
Anyone who's religious is going to hear that and go, that's the whole point of life. Life is literally a trial phase to weigh if you're good or bad.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I have a little bit of that I'm not religious overtly, but I suppose some of that religiosity has permeated my, you know, good, bad, heaven, hell, right, wrong mentality.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does. But then it's also true that the majority of people who kind of have this conception that like religion just tells you that, you know, you're here to, as a trial, to find out if you're good or bad. And it's basically kind of a game to see if we'll get into heaven. Like, that's not a position that would be held by like serious, you know, religious scholars, for instance. They think mm-hmm. the goodness and badness is not defined by kind of what's going to get you into heaven per se. It's to do with like the nature of God. God is good by nature. And so doing things which are kind of in accordance with what a human being should properly do as determined by God is good, regardless of whether it gets you into heaven or not. And that people shouldn't be motivated to goodness or badness by heaven, but by the fact that it's what is proper of a human being or something, right? Like the difficulty is that we're talking about practical ethics when we talk about something like veganism. And practical ethics has to sit on top of meta-ethics. Meta-ethics being the more fundamental discussion of what is good? What does goodness mean? What's badness? What's mm-hmm. it all grounded in? And you can only really have one conversation at a time because they both take up too much time, right? And if you're going to talk about practical ethics, it's always going to be true that there's going to be someone listening who's going to say, well, that just doesn't apply to my worldview.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of the difficulty of doing ethics. So you're right. Like, you know, there are many religious people who would absolutely shirk at this idea that ethics is grounded in suffering. It's like, mm-hmm. what ethics is grounded in just pleasure, pain, that kind of stuff. Are you suggesting that it seriously might be okay to kill an innocent person if they don't feel suffering or something like that? These thoughts are going to kind of rage through their heads. And there are answers to those questions. But yeah, you're never going to be able to have an ethical discussion that satisfies everyone in the room.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm going in so many different directions. I suppose I'm most fascinated by meta-ethics. And I'll just to keep this particular question alive, and I'm curious how you think about it. I guess I've raised the specter that it is the case that there's some sentience in plants, right? And there then is the option for you as someone who eats plants to eat half as much, which might be important. And again, forget whether it makes you a good or a bad person. It could be doubling the suffering of plants. Is that a bridge too far for you? Is that something worth considering? How do we even know? And then I wonder, in 1,000 years, will they then look back on us and be like, those people were eating all of those plants. Like, how dare they?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you circled back to this specific question because I didn't want to kind of forget to address it directly.
Yeah.
What we're really tapping into is the demandingness objection to consequentialist ethics, generally mm-hmm. speaking. This it's an objection in the form of saying that, like, there's always something you can do that makes mm-hmm. things a little bit better, that don't actually require that much of a sacrifice. You know, like, although, yeah, I'm a video producer, so it's probably a good idea that I have an SM7B, and so do you both. Like, this wouldn't be a failure of an interview if I had a slightly cheaper microphone, mm-hmm. right? And I could have taken that money and done something better with it and sure. had a better consequence, caused mm-hmm. less suffering by donating it to charity. And the question is, like, how far are we allowed to take that? Now, mm-hmm. with the question of like food and veganism, most vegans will agree that essentially sustainable health is the bar here. But this isn't so much like a meta-ethical position. It's just a practical position so that we can move the conversation forward. Mm-hmm. We'll basically say that, like, so long as you can be healthy with what you're eating, that's what's justifiable. Everything kind of above that. So like, if you need to cause some kind of suffering because it's necessary, then, like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the moment that you, like, are able to be healthy, right, if you cause any suffering beyond that, you're doing something immoral. The problem is, as you say, like, okay, so let's say you're like perfectly healthy, right? You could maybe like live with a slight iron deficiency. Right? It's not something you'd like advocate, right? But like, you know, if we're talking about meta ethics, like you could do it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And by doing so, you know, maybe by eating slightly less plants or eating whatever diet you have, by eating a bit less, you're freeing up a bit of land, you're saving a bit of water, all of this kind of stuff. And like, although it is a cost to you at this point, it's not much of a cost. I think because this is a difficult question to answer practically, I like to say no, like, your obligation only goes as far as like staying healthy does, right? But there is an interesting kind of meta-ethical question about, like, should you like break your arm if it's going to like save a child from dying or something. Mm-hmm. The way to kind of entertain this question, I think, is through the eyes of the most famous way that this problem is usually phrased is through the words of Peter Singer, who in his essay, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, asked people to imagine a you're kind of walking down the road and you come across a really shallow pond, right? You'll probably be familiar with this. I'm sure your audience might be too. It's a very famous thought experiment. And you come to notice that there's a child drowning in the pond, right? And you think to yourself, well, like, I could save this child very easily, but it would like ruin my shoes. I'd have to get some new shoes that cost me like $100, right? And so I don't save the child. I just walk on with my day. You would think I'm a moral monster for doing this. You'd think I'm the most evil person in the world. But isn't that exactly what we do every time we refuse to give $100 to charity, mm-hmm. right? Because there's a child not drowning in front of me, but dying on the other side of the world. Mm-hmm. And I say, no, I'm not going to give up that $100 to save their life because I want to, you know, buy some shoes or something. Mm-hmm. It seems really unethical. And Peter Singer's point is to say, well, actually, these situations are the same. If you'd save the drowning child, you should give your money to charity. But then someone comes along and says, well, hold on. Like this, there's like an endless supply of people dying, of suffering that you could be, you know, responsible for mitigating.
Yeah.
Endless supply. You could like, you know, refuse to buy shoes, downsize your house, you know, refuse to have a kid because it's going to, you know, it's going to cost more money and contribute to overpopulation. You could sell all of your clothes except maybe a t-shirt, you know, why not kind of stop shaving your face? Because the cost of a razor mm-hmm. could be spent buying a malaria net and saving someone across the world from dying of malaria.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And the objection essentially is that like, surely at some point we have to say, no, you are actually allowed to engage in even trivial things like buying a nice pair of shoes, shaving your face, going to the theater. Because if we don't allow that, then we can't allow any of it. And everybody just has to live in absolute abject misery so long as that misery doesn't quite dip below the amount of suffering they're responsible for saving. Mm-hmm. So I think a good way around this is to say that we should be responsible for the suffering that we're causing rather than the suffering that we're avoiding. We should say that the gray area kind of lies in like when there's an opportunity to save someone from suffering, like saving the drowning child, it can often be a gray area of how far that applies. But if you're directly responsible for the suffering, that's a different story. You might not have an obligation to send money to save a child from dying in Ethiopia, but you do have an obligation to refrain from putting some cyanide in the post and sending it to them and killing them, right? So the mm-hmm. first thing we need to do is make sure we prevent ourselves from being responsible for that kind of suffering.
So would that thought process allow you to walk past the kid in the pond so as to not ruin your shoes because you didn't put the kid in the pond?
I don't think so. I'm not saying that you should never be obligated to, you know, mm-hmm. prevent suffering when you can. I'm just saying that like it's usually where the gray areas exist, it's in those areas of prevention rather than where mm-hmm. you've actually caused.
Oh, sorry. I'm not saying you should walk past, but I'm saying, wouldn't that thought process allow someone to walk past?
Yes, many times. I mean, and that's the thought experiment, is that there's 10 million ponds with 10 million children everywhere.
I'm not saying you're encouraging people to walk past, but I'm saying you can't
saying it's permissible.
Judge yes. right. people for walking
past. That's not
past.
What I'm saying, because I'm not saying that it's always permissible to mm-hmm. refuse to save someone. I'm saying that it's sometimes, depending on the situation, probably permissible. But the thing that we have to make sure we're doing is being consistent. So with Peter Singer's example, he says, you know, if you'd saved a drowning child, you should donate to charity. It's like, it doesn't quite work. Let's actually make the situations identical. There's a paper that was written called something like, sometimes it's okay to let the child drown or something mm-hmm. like that. So it's basically kind of the conclusion that you'd want to kind of avoid like the plague. But he phrases it by saying this. He says, well, look, imagine now that you're kind of on your way to work or whatever. I think the exact way that he frames it is says that there are some hackers who have broken into your bank account and they're taking out maybe like $5 or $100, whatever it is, every 5 minutes, right? So every 5 minutes, they're taking out, say, $100. And because of some legal loophole, there's nothing the bank can do to stop them. So the only way to stop them is you have to actually go to the bank and, you know, freeze your account. And once the money's run out of your account, the bank will just start seizing your assets up to the value of $100 every single 5 minutes until you go to the bank and stop it. So you get up, you go to the bank, but just as you're about to get into the bank, you notice that there is this ocean of drowning children, just endless drowning children. And it takes exactly 5 minutes to save one of those children, mm-hmm. right? So probably you should stop and save some of the children, right? Because it's like, yeah, you're going to delay yourself from shutting your bank. You're going to lose a few $100, but you should save the children. But how many children should you save? Mm-hmm. Like how far are we actually going to allow this to happen? And the conclusion of the essay is to say that like, Peter Singer's objection seems to imply, or Peter Singer's argument seems to imply, that you should basically let the bank seize all of your assets right up until the moment when you are like completely desolate, just completely desolate as the drowning children are. Then you're allowed to kind of think for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Because you should always, if you can prevent someone else's suffering without sacrificing something considerably important of yours, you should always do it. But this guy says, look, clearly we wouldn't say it's permissible to just walk past the children. We wouldn't say you can just save none of the children and go and save your money. But equally, we wouldn't say that they have an obligation to let the bank seize their house, seize their car, you know, take everything away from them. There needs to be a point at which we say, actually, yeah, no, now I'm going to stop saving these children, and I'm going to kind of stop my money from taking it out of the bank. Now, the next question is this, like, we could probably agree that when the bank starts kind of taking the house, taking the car, these necessities, as it were, you know, you're allowed to put that to a stop. You're allowed to say, okay, I can't save any more children. They're going to take my house. I've got to go and shut it down. But like, what about more trivial things? What if it's like, you know, the money that you were going to spend going out for dinner or something? It's like, it seems like you shouldn't allow a child to die for that. But like, imagine this situation happens every single day. Every single day of your life, these children are dying, mm-hmm. and you have to go to the bank to stop it every single day. Are you, for the rest of your life, are you never, ever allowed to ever go out for dinner again? Are you never, ever allowed to do any unnecessary purchase? You can't buy yourself new shoes. You can't get married to your fiance. You can't, because you can't afford it. And because you're spending all of your time saving these children. I think people would say, no, that's not fair. Like, even in terms of like trivial things, there is a point at which you're able to say, I'm actually allowed to permit this significant amount of suffering for the sake of, you know, for the sake of something that I just want to do. But the key point is that it's about like finding balance here, right? Mm-hmm. You can't let all of the children die, but you shouldn't be obligated to try and save all of the children at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems, and I moral philosophers have been working through, I think, a world, essentially the problem is there's a tremendous amount of suffering in the world. And that's only if we include the suffering that we often think of as being avoidable. But the animal kingdom is quite obviously full of suffering without our inclusion in it, right? If you ever go to Nature is Lit, it's horrifying what these animals do to one another in order to get a meal. And it seems like moral philosophers are really struggling. And really what that thought experiment does, as I think about it, is it tries to force consistency such that you're removing the distance between America and Africa or elsewhere. But to me, it only just marks that morality, as it is often used, is more of a societal tool than it is a good with a capital G, right? What we're trying to find is what creates a cohesive society that our own axioms make consistent and copacetic for us. But even as you were discussing it, I think you were appropriately saying, what are you allowed to do? It's more about what we permit of one another than it is the pursuit of good with a capital G or the avoidance of evil or things like that, which I think is totally fine.
Well, I also think these thought processes are how people justify selfishness or causing suffering, which is to say...
And by people, I mean myself, the way.
It's how you could justify giving no money to charity, or it's how you could justify eating cows because you did a blood test and it turns out that genetically you're predisposed to eating meat. Or there's people who go on the carnivore diet and it helps them with their anxiety and depression. So in terms of perfect health, they should be killing animals constantly. So I think, I guess all I'm saying is that the thought process that we just went through says all of that is okay. Donating very little to charity, eating cows if you think it makes you healthier than eating plants. Mm-hmm. And so as I sit here, I'm not sure I like the conclusions and I'm not sure, I guess, where I disagree in the story.
Well, that's only true if you think that it's okay to walk past the essay that I mentioned. And I think most people who read it would agree is not the case, right? We don't, in this situation with the bank seizing your assets every day, we don't say that you can just ignore all of the suffering, that you can just kind of, you know, maybe help one child out and be done with it. We say, no, there's a very serious obligation to actually, you know, save a considerable amount of the suffering that you can. We're just saying that it doesn't, that it's not entirely clear kind of how far it stretches. So like, it's not like, hey, this is an excuse for you to big charity. It's a way of you simultaneously holding that I should be giving significantly to charity, but also kind of allowing yourself to not have to give literally everything you own, right? It's not that the conclusion of the thought experiment there is not that we should be able.
Did we lose you for a second?
Yeah, we don't have an obligation to save absolutely every single one of them because we can't.
Sorry.
Did you lose me?
Yes, just for a second. We were hearing you wind down, but I think I understood where you were headed with that.
Sure.
I'm going to take my phone off the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, well, we'll disconnect everything from Wi-Fi.
It's probably more my end than your end. My internet is quite unreliable at the moment. I'm supposed to be at St. John's College in Oxford City, but unfortunately I'm stuck at home because they won't have us back.
Yeah. No, I guess, and just to sort of underline, I think what's interesting is that we're just playing devil's advocate for one another, and I don't think that you're obligated to defend the pond analogy, and I think Ben probably agrees with it, as do I in many ways. I'm noticing though that there are, as you recognized, a lot of fudge words. You know, what is necessary? What is health? And and I think Ben's point was
arguments of convenience. I guess is what I'm saying, which is to say, so. Maybe I'm someone who gives 1% of my income a year. Mm-hmm. And you would like for everyone to give, let's just say 10%. And you say, hey, why do you only give 1%? And I go, well, I'm not obligated to not buy the shoes and go to dinner and get the latest iPhone and get a car that I can't, you know, I have a regular job, but I get a BMW i8. And like, I'm not obligated to do that because of this Peter Schiff metaphor.
Not Peter Schiff, Peter Singer.
Because I...
Very different dudes.
Because I donate 1%. You know, I'm doing my part. And you, I imagine most people go, whoa, it'd be nice for you to maybe not have a $150,000 car if you can only afford to give $10 to charity or maybe get a $80,000 car, which is still insanely expensive, and give more than $10 to charity. And they go, well, you know, I think I'm doing my part. And similarly to the plant, it's like, oh, let's go to Perfect Health. And now you're in an argument with whether you can have perfect health as a vegan. And I imagine that there's a lot of people that are smarter than I who could make strong arguments as to why for their specific blood type, body type, whatever it might be, that cow is an integral part of that. And so that's all. As I'm walking through these philosophical conversations, I can just see where one could hop in and use the thought process to make an argument of convenience.
I think I see the way that, to me, makes it sort of come together, which is if you're using these thought experiments as a bare limit on what you must do and you genuinely do not care about the kid in the pond, you will find a way to save as few children in the ponds as possible.
That's what I'm saying.
And just exactly. So if that's what morality is going to become, is some sort of social... is merely what it is to become, some sort of social enforcement mechanism on the bare minimum that you must do in order to not be excommunicated from society, that's what you'll get. But I think the goal is internally to extend your circle of concern farther, such that the children are compelling to you by themselves. And it's not a sacrifice to downgrade from the $150,000 car. It is a loving, happy decision that one has made. And that, I guess, the goal for me is to become a person who is happier and happier to personally have less and less because I am genuinely made happy by what I'm able to spread. And that seems like moral evolution as opposed to what I've considered in the past, which is like, what do I have to do even though I don't like it?
That's right. I guess the reason I think about it is because we all have our YouTube channels and we all have people who listen to us, and you would like to be, the metaphor I always use is, if you're in a world where there's slavery, you'd like to be on the forefront of helping slavery not exist anymore. And so then I think, well, what arguments are going to be persuasive? And so that's the lens I'm viewing this through, I guess, is let's say I do eat meat, or let's say I don't donate to charity. Is this persuasive? And I struggle to find anything. I've even had conversations where at the end of the day, the person's like, yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I'm not going to change my behavior, but I have no counter arguments. So I go,
maybe this is a good direction for us to head. Is
here we are.
You've had a ton of these conversations, I'm sure. What is persuasive when it comes to veganism and increasing one's ethical concern such that it inconveniences oneself?
I'm afraid there are about as many different ways to convince people as there are different people, right? But I think you're right to pick up on this point that you did a second ago. There are kind of two ways of thinking about the way we're doing ethics here. One of which is like, people saying that the reason that we have these discussions, the reason we bring up these thought experiments is so that I can kind of construct a cop out to allow me to continue conveniently and kind of ethically justifying it. If that's what you think that we're kind of doing here, then we're not having the same conversation, because I think like the reason I'm doing this is to find out what's actually, you know, ethically true, if there is such a thing.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
It's not just about constructing a functional system that we can use to kind of say that we're allowed to do this, we're allowed to do that. It's like, I just actually want to know the truth of the matter. Like, is there an actual true answer to the question of whether or not this thing is right or wrong? Mm. When it comes to convincing people, the point to make is that, like, I'm just trying to get people to be consistent, right? Now, one of the biggest problems that we face is when someone says, I agree with you, but I'm just not motivated to change. Mm-hmm. But this isn't a problem that's unique to veganism. Even though it's the only situation in which I tend to hear it brought up, it would be the same thing if you were talking with somebody who believed something else that you thought was unethical. Like, pick anything you think is unethical, take racism or something, and you convince somebody that it's baseless, doesn't make any sense. And they turn around and say, you know what? You're right, but I'm just still going to be a racist. Like, there's not really much you can do there. All the ethicist can do is basically say, I think you're wrong. Like, I think what you're doing is ethically wrong. So yeah, like, what I like to do is kind of reframe the way in which I'm talking about people being right and wrong, not to kind of mean ethically right or wrong here, but like right in terms of correct or wrong in terms of incorrect. Mm-hmm. So here's what I find is convincing, right? I say this, like, you already believe that it's wrong to put certain types of animals into gas chambers, you know, for instance, human beings. Yeah. A lot of people think it would be wrong to do it to dogs as well, which is an easier starting point. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's less of an argument that needs to be made here. Like, if somebody thinks that it's wrong to put a dog into a gas chamber because, you know, of the taste of their flesh or something, which is how 86% of pigs are killed in my country, at least, for meat, is by gassing them in a chamber of carbon dioxide, which is an incredibly painful way to go. So if we think it would be wrong to do it to a dog, the question kind of ethics isn't necessary anymore, because we just kind of agree on this base ethical principle, and you might believe it for different reasons than me, but we both believe it's wrong to put the dog in the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. The question then simply becomes, like, how like a pig would that dog have to be, and in what ways to make it okay to have them in that gas chamber, right? Like, if I change the dog's skin color, so it's now pink, and we give it a curly tail, like, it's got the same intelligence as a pig, looks like a pig, talks like a pig, would you still think it's wrong? Like, you won't really be able to find the descriptive difference. Now, we can actually extend this argument to human beings as well, right? Because some people would say, well, yeah, some people do kill dogs for food, I think it's kind of okay or whatever. Put it this way, right? If we put a human being into a gas chamber, it'd be wrong, so wrong, in fact, that it's evocative of one of the worst evils in human history, right? Mm-hmm. But if we put a pig into a gas chamber, then it's the way that many people get their breakfast. Now, obviously, humans and pigs are very, very different creatures. But the question to ask is specifically, how are they different? Like, in what specific ways are they different? And which of those different ways is morally relevant, right? So, if we took the human being and we took the human being's arms and turned them into legs, is it now okay to put that human being in the gas chamber? Well, no, clearly not, right? If I change the human being's skin color, so now they've got pink skin, right? Is it now morally okay to put them in a gas chamber? Still no, right? Obviously not. That's not relevant. Okay, what if I take that human being and I lower their intelligence to the level of a pig, say? Can I now put them in the gas chamber? No, we certainly can't justify killing people on the basis of their intelligence. You can't say that because someone's got less intelligence, they've got less moral worth because of it. But it's like, okay, so now we've got like this human being that we've now turned into a being that has like the brain of a pig. It's as intelligent as a pig. It kind of looks like a pig. It's got a tail like a pig. It's got four legs and everything. You've basically now got this being that is identical to a pig, right? But you haven't found a point at which you say, okay, now it's okay to put them in the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. So you've got this thing, which is essentially a pig, that you're still saying, no, it's still not okay to put them in the gas chamber. But you've got an identical creature over here that we, you know, originally at the beginning of this say, well, this one's okay to put in the gas chamber because that's how people get their breakfast. The point to make is that, like, it's not really a moral discussion that we're having anymore. It's that you've got a descriptive inconsistency, right? Because I've kind of walked you through metamorphizing this human being into a pig. And at no point have you stopped and said, okay, now it's okay to put them in the gas chamber. You know, when you lower their intelligence, that's what makes it okay to put them in the gas chamber. Like, that hasn't happened. But now you've got this thing which is identical to a pig that you say is still wrong to put in a gas chamber. And what that means is that you're simultaneously saying that it would be wrong to put this being, which is identical to a pig, into a gas chamber, at the same time as saying that this identical creature, it's fine to put into a gas chamber. That's an inconsistency. You're saying it's both okay and not okay to put this being into a gas chamber. You're wrong, not morally speaking, but like you're incorrect. Like, logically speaking, that contradicts. So like, that's usually where I would start, is to say the question you have to answer is that if you already think it's wrong to put, say, a human being into a gas chamber, you have to answer, like, how like a pig and in what ways would that human being have to be to make it okay to put them in the gas chamber? If you can't answer that question, then you can't treat them that ethically differently, if you see what I'm saying.
Sure. So I follow very, very closely, and I've had similar arguments and discussions with people, and perhaps I turn them into arguments because that's my habit. But I will say what I've found is that for change making, I find that very ineffective. Yeah, like perhaps only with my philosopher friends, and with the broad swath of the population, even the people that love me the most, it's like, yeah. And then they will just go and order whatever they feel like in 3 seconds. So I actually wanted to point out, I don't know if you're doing it consciously, but I think one thing that your videos do very well is you cut in like 2 to 3 seconds of footage of these gas chambers and of the way that this actually happens. And part of the reason that I watch your videos is not to hear you say the arguments that I'm familiar with. It's for those 2 to 3 seconds of like, oh yeah, this is what it is, in a visceral, emotional way. And when I do talk to people that have gone vegan, I found out one of the most common reasons is Cowspiracy, which is a documentary where the guy, he was totally a vegan before, but he baby steps you all the way there in this pretend way and show, and it's very emotionally impactful. So I'm just curious if you are aware that you're sort of doing that with the imagery, or if that's something that just kind of happened. I find that you're at this Goldilocks zone of like, if I ask people to sit down and say, let's watch Dominion, the Joaquin Phoenix expose on slaughterhouses, they're like, no way. But if I'm like, hey, check out this 9-minute video, 8 of it has this very eloquent British dude, and 1 minute interspersed throughout is some horrible imagery, they're more likely to watch that and be moved by it. So I'm curious if you've seen anything like that in terms of persuasiveness, that it's not just logic, but there's something else that needs to be in place.
Yeah, well, that's precisely the problem, is that logic alone doesn't tend to motivate. The reason why I have to rely on logic is because there are kind of two levels of convincingness here, right? Mm-hmm. There's being convinced in terms of thinking that something is like ethically correct, and there's being convinced in the sense of kind of actually acting in accordance with it. So you're more interested in the second here. Mm-hmm. The reason I began with this is to say that, like, because I'm essentially a philosopher, right? Yep. Like my channel is a philosophy channel. Most of the people watching are interested in philosophical argument. So now I could show them a bunch of footage and say, this is obviously horrible, because clearly, like, if you look at what we're currently doing to animals, like, you know, in terms of our industry standard practices, and you're not disgusted and upset by it, then there's something wrong with you, right? It's very clear that, like, there's a very strong emotional effect of presenting this footage. However, if I present it to my audience, half of them are going to turn around and say, well, yeah, no, you're right. Like, I feel horrible about this, but, like, you know, I don't want an argument that's based on emotion.
Sure.
I don't want, that's a fallacy to appeal to emotion. I want something based on logic and facts, right? So for them, I say, all right, well, let me convince you with this argument. You're just descriptively incorrect. And then that person can then go, okay, I already agreed that it was emotionally compelling. Mm-hmm. Now I see the logic, so I'm going to go ahead and do it.
Got it.
There are some people who do the exact opposite. They say, well, yeah, I agree that it's logically true, but there's no like emotional pull for me. Mm-hmm. For those people, I then say, well, look, if you need some emotional input, then yeah, look at this footage. So I like to make sure that it's at least present, so it's there for those people, but I can't rely on it, because otherwise people would accuse me quite rightfully of just appealing to emotion. You know, like, an argument for veganism might consist in saying, come on, man, look at the poor cows. Don't hurt the cows. Don't hurt the pigs. It sucks so much. And yeah, that might convince someone to go vegan. Sure. But like, somebody who's coming at it from a kind of philosophy of ethics perspective isn't going to be very impressed. So I'm glad to hear that you think I've kind of struck a balance there, because that's essentially what I'm trying to do. Because I'll get criticism either way. If I show the footage, people say it's not logical. If I provide logic, people say it's not going to make them change. So we need both. In terms of what actually does convince people to start acting in accordance with it, it's difficult to say, because again, it's difficult for, it's different for different people. But I think that kind of looking at the footage is one of the best ways to do it. Now, like, I find it hard to wrap my head around, because for me, I remember when I used to see these documentaries, this footage of animals suffering, and it didn't really do much for me. Like, I looked at it and I thought, this is obviously horrible, but I'm not going to change my life based on this emotional impulse that I'm having, right? It took me reading The Philosophy to change my mind. But I recognize that from what I've learned now, I'm like a minority in that. That's the kind of thing that convinces me. I've had lots of other friends who, like, have talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked forever and ever and ever. It's only when they actually sit down and watch Land of Hope and Glory, which is a UK version of Earthlings, essentially. It's only when they sit down and watch those documentaries that they finally change. But there are still people out there, you know, like me, who will only be convinced by what is essentially an ethically consistent logical argument. So I need to make sure that's provided too. But I'm under no illusion that that's going to, on its own, convince everybody to go vegan.
For sure. No, I think it's funny. You must, you know, you said you're at St. John's right now, and you've got a channel of people interested in philosophy, and you yourself are very logically oriented. My own limited experience of humans that are not those YouTubers is the emotional appeal is the effective way to go. But I think it's great that you're doing both.
So if I hunt wildlife by euthanizing it painlessly in its sleep, and then I eat that, you're not opposed to that. That is in line with your ethics. It's like you can be a vegan plus eat animals that you euthanized at night.
I wouldn't see, sorry, my connection just went a little bit funny, but I think I'm okay. Am I okay?
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, we got you.
Your question was about the deer
hunting at night. So
there's a family of four deer, and I walk up and I inject them with the same thing you use to put down a dog that you love. You know, it's painless. Yeah. They just are dead. There's four of them. They have no family beyond this. And then I eat those deer. So then there's been no suffering. I would have thought that that's still wrong. I wouldn't want someone to do that to my dog, which is kind of my framework for what.
Yeah, but that's the key point there, is that you wouldn't want someone to do that to your dog, right? I don't think it would be bad for the dog, right? Like,
So this is what I'm saying. The deer aren't owned by a human. So I can, I'm actually okay to sneak around at night like a ninja, euthanize family of deer, as long as I get the whole family, and then eat those deer. Like, I do it once a year, and then that deer lasts a year.
That's the thing. Like, in practice, you'd have to kind of fulfill so many qualifications that it would be almost impossible to make sure you're actually doing it. In principle, though, because the question you're asking is interesting because of the principle, like, I wouldn't really have a problem with it. You know, like, as far as I'm concerned, if there's no suffering, there's no problem, right? There might be a...
Interesting.
We need to be consistent here. So as I say, like, if we think it'd be wrong to do it to a human or other animals, like a dog, we should probably think it's wrong to do it to a deer. My own ethical intuitions say that it wouldn't be bad for the person being killed. Potentially the only consideration worth bearing in mind is that it might be in some sense bad for the person who has to do the killing. Like, it's kind of, it creates a kind of less than kind of morally, what's the word I'm looking for?
Some character within
yourself if you do that action. But like, the action in and of itself,
Why would it create stain if it's not a bad thing to do? And it creates, if bad is only suffering and it causes no suffering, why would it be bad to do?
Why would it create some sort of character defect?
Because I'm causing no suffering.
If it genuinely causes no suffering, then I don't think it's, I can't see any reason to think that it would be like morally impermissible.
Got it. So then let me ask you this one. There's an old man at the end of his life. He's got very little pleasure left to be had. I sneak up on him. I'm a young guy, lots of pleasure. I love the taste of flesh. I inject him painlessly, and then I eat him. He would have survived another 6 months to a year. I get a meal. He didn't miss much pleasure. He was kind of a miserable guy. Is that permissible if conscious awareness of suffering is our only metric.
Well, I think that if it is wrong, it's not wrong because of like it's bad for the person that you've killed. Like, I don't think it's bad for the person you've killed. So if it is wrong, mm-hmm. which is the question we're exploring, it must be wrong for some other reason. For example, there is a trouble with even the act of saying that this is morally permissible is problematic because of the fact that like if people become aware that this is something that's morally permissible, it's going to cause upset. It's going to cause worry as well for people who are in that situation. It's kind of like, you know how people say you wouldn't kill a person because, you know, it would scare everybody else. It's kind of like a kind of more fundamental version of that, which is to say that, let's say, no, we're going to qualify it such that anytime this happens, we totally make unknown. Sure yeah. that this person genuinely, nobody else knows who they are. Genuinely no family, genuinely nothing like that. And we're going to kill them. Like, we might say, yeah, okay, because you've fulfilled all the conditions, it's now okay to do so. Mm-hmm. But the very act of saying that it's okay to do so is going to be problematic, right? So like the act qua the act, like the act in itself might not be, on a suffering-based worldview, ethically impermissible, but it wouldn't be permissible to grant it the status of permissibility. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? Like in a kind of meta-analysis, although like, qua the act, right, in virtue of the act itself, you might, you know, someone like me might be committed to saying, no, it's not wrong. It's not sure. wrong to kill that person. I could say that, like, to grant it permissibility is itself impermissible. And for that reason, I can't say that it's permissible.
But right? since animals...
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But since animals can't
worry
hear English...
And worry about that, yeah.
Then that's not an issue. So as long as you're taking out the entire family...
And making sure that there's no suffering
in
of children.
In a painless way.
Yeah. But actually,
because this isn't how I feel, by the way. I
have a different axiom here.
I
see what the problem.
I'm walking through. I wonder if this is an insufficient view mm-hmm.
It's only insufficient if like you're reasoning in reverse. I mean, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to find an ethical theory that we think is sound and see what it implies? Or are we saying, well, I've got these ethical beliefs that I want to keep. And so if this ethical theory doesn't abide by it, I'm going to throw it out. Yeah, that's not how we should do ethics. Like if it turns out that actually it is okay to kill a family of elk or something, then that would just be how it is, right? We can't reject an ethical theory.
I'm the guy that turned cosmic skeptic non-vegan. I did it. I can't believe it. I didn't want to be that guy, but I'm that guy.
You know, like now somebody who was about to go out and like hunt some deer is actually now going to go and hunt an entire family of deer.
I didn't want to be that guy.
And to your point,
here I am.
Go ahead. Sorry. It's getting skippy.
I think I actually lost you for a second there.
No, I saw you were about to speak.
You were talking about the hunter taking out a whole family of deer.
Yeah, sorry. I just lost you for a second there. I wasn't just kind of trying to sit staring at you. we have to be careful to stress that in practice, such situations don't really arise. You can never actually know that you've fulfilled all the conditions such that this genuinely isn't causing any suffering, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so in practice, it doesn't, like, it's not like I'm saying, yeah, it's fine. Go around in the forest mm-hmm. and just kind of hunt deer because of the fact that you're not going to kill them painlessly. It's going to be impossible to do that every single time. You're not going to be sure that they don't have, you know, family or whatever who care about them, et cetera, et cetera. You're never going to actually be able to fill those conditions. But on a kind of matter of ethical principle, we can have this interesting conclusion and you know, potentially like some clickbaity title. Cosmic Skeptic admits that it's okay to eat a deer, you know, like in principle, yeah. But like,
yeah,
there are all kinds of, as long as we make the actual conditions correct, pretty much anything we think is immoral could be permissible in some circumstance. You know, mm-hmm. we would think that murder is okay in some circumstances. People think that torture is okay in some circumstances. If the only way to find out where the bomb is that's about to explode in Manhattan is to torture the person who set it up, most people would, well, a lot of people at least, would say, yeah, we can torture them, even though generally speaking, like, yeah, if somebody whose campaign was to bring about an end to torture in war or in, you know, whatever it may be, like torture is just something that shouldn't be allowed. If you pressed them on this and said, yeah, but if the bomb was about to go off in New York City, would you torture the person? And they said, look, if all of these conditions were fulfilled, I think this would be morally permissible. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they're still allowed to say that they're against torture, that torture is wrong, that in practice we should never torture people. But like in principle, as a point of kind of ethical principle, we can say that there are circumstances in which it might be permissible. Mm-hmm. But in practice, it doesn't really matter because that's never going to come up.
Sure. Sure. And of course the semantics and the labeling is secondary to the, in my opinion, the behavior and all of that stuff. So
yeah.
Well, you did raise one interesting thing, which you said, what are we doing here? Are we creating principles? And I actually realized that what I am doing, right or wrong, is starting from, I think, my most charitable ethical instinct and then trying to universalize that, which is a little bit different than what you're doing. You're a little bit more committed to the logical truth, as it were, of ethics. And it's just interesting. And that's I guess why I still land on, look, it's not justifiable necessarily. I can't explain why, but you don't kill people even if it's painless in most situations.
The only thing to bear in mind is that like if somebody's criticizing you, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody is coming along and saying, like, I'm someone who wants to eat meat, right? I don't buy all this vegan stuff. And they start prodding and they start saying, oh, but come on, man. Like, you know, if a deer in the forest, it doesn't feel any pain, et cetera, et cetera. And you're still kind of clinging to this, like, no, it's still wrong. It's always going to be wrong. You know, like they might think like this person's ethical position isn't fully thought through. Right. Because like when I talk to people and they say, what if the animal feels no suffering? And I say, well, if there's no suffering, there's no problem. You know, if a cow can't suffer, then you can kill the cow. Sure. Like oftentimes, their response is to go, huh, oh, right, fair enough. Actually, yeah, that does make sense then. Yeah, I can see why you'd think this. That makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, the fact that in practice, cows do suffer means that they now think my position is consistent and cows do suffer, so I should probably stop killing them. Whereas if I were to go, no, even if cows couldn't suffer, you still shouldn't kill them because, you know, they're a cow or whatever, or because for some kind of reason that I couldn't really actually justify, they would be in their rights to say, ah, so your position is kind of grounded on nothing. It doesn't actually have any consistency. I'm not going to give you the time of day, right? So we have to actually be honest about the limits of our ethical position here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in most circumstances, in pretty much any circumstance that you're ever actually going to practically find yourself in, it will be wrong to kill this animal unnecessarily.
Well, I think
that, like, to say that there's never an exception is to be myopic about it.
Oh, I think the difference is I had previously held this position that I don't really know how I feel about, which is that in addition to you don't want to cause suffering, there's also the sense of, sure, when I murder someone, they don't know that they've been murdered. But if they were given the choice, they would have chosen to live. And so is it immoral to take something's life knowing that they would have chosen to live, whether that's a human who's old, a family of deer? And so if that
there's one big problem with that. Mm-hmm. There's one really big problem with that, as far as I can see. You know, that you might have a response, but if we're talking in terms of conditionals, right? Because we're essentially saying, like, this person doesn't exist anymore, right? They don't exist. So there's nothing that can be true of them. But we're saying, but like, if they did exist, you know, in the possible world in which they do exist, they would prefer to live.
No,
and that gives me an obligation not to kill them.
The moment before I killed them, right, they wanted to live. And I overruled that desire.
Okay. So that's slightly different, although there is still a problem, which is that we're now kind of trying to ground ethics in desire fulfillment, right? And the question is it harmful to a person to have their desires go unfulfilled if they're not aware that those desires have gone unfulfilled? Like, the person before they die want to continue living, and that desire they have is violated. But if they don't know the desire is violated, is it bad for them? And there are a few ways to explore this question. For example, there is imagine that you're on a train, right? And you meet a stranger on the train who's sat next to you on the train, and you just strike up a conversation, and it turns out that they've got a very dangerous operation happening next week. And, you know, there's a 20% chance that it's going to kill them. It's going to be horrible and painful and tragic. And you think to yourself, damn, like, I want this person's operation to go well. Like, I care about this person, right? And they get off the train. You never got their name. You're never going to hear from them again. No way to contact them. But you have this very real desire that their operation goes well, right? Now, let's say that their operation goes horribly. They die in a horrible accident. It's horribly painful. The question is that bad for you, right? Your desire has gone unfulfilled. It's been violated, right? Like, you had this desire that this person has a successful operation. They didn't, but you will never, ever know that that's the case. Is it bad for you that their operation went wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting, I would say my initial response, having not thought about it too deeply, is that no, it is not bad for you. And it seems that what this thought process does is it separates the desirer from the person who suffered the death.
It's interesting. Yeah, what it shows is that like it's not just about kind of having the desire kind of violated that's bad. It's you have to like be aware that your desire has not been fulfilled. So if someone has a desire to continue living before they die, and then they die, they're not aware that that desire has gone unfulfilled. So in the same way that it's not bad for the person on the train, because yeah, their desire has gone unfulfilled, but they don't know about it. Well, the person who wanted not to die isn't aware that their desire goes unfulfilled when they die. And so it can't be bad for them either.
No, it's interesting because I don't think you'll think this is bad. If you already eat slaughterhouse meat, this ethic will take you closer to being a vegan. As someone who doesn't at the moment eat mammals, it's taken me further from vegan because now we've identified a condition in which it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not bad.
No, it's not
bad.
Basically, what you're saying
is if you came over and I was eating venison, you would be like, okay, if this was because you killed an entire family in their sleep with a knife to the throat, then I guess I'll have some too.
And then the two of us could eat venison together. In practice, I would stress that in practice, like that wouldn't, that those conditions probably wouldn't be fulfilled such that I'd be like, actually, yeah, I mean, that was a fine thing to do. But like, you're right. But I'll just like remind you and remind your listeners that the definition of veganism is a minimization to the highest extent practicable of all forms of animal suffering. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that if you're kind of not causing suffering to an animal, then what you're doing isn't non-vegan, because veganism is about minimizing suffering.
Got it.
So if you're killing an animal that genuinely doesn't suffer from it, then you couldn't be like, well, this is moving me away from veganism because, you know, I can kill this animal now. No, it's not. Because killing that animal in that circumstance would be a vegan thing to do, because veganism is about suffering. And if that animal can't suffer, then it's not non-vegan to kill them, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I don't think you are actually moving away from veganism. I think you're just kind of beginning to like—
redefine veganism.
More refined, in a more refined sense, understand what I mean when I say vegan.
Cool. Would you eat eggs? Like, well, if there was just animals that were laying eggs in the wild and the eggs couldn't turn into babies?
Well, if they were just laying them and we were literally just kind of like, if we happen across them in the forest or something.
Yeah, we're like on a walk and we just find it.
Yeah, like absolutely. Okay, I don't see a problem with that. It's really funny. I made a TikTok not long ago about backyard chicken farming, because people were like, what's the problem with having chickens in my backyard? And I basically said, look, it still matters where you got the chickens from, because you probably bought them from like a breeder. They're still probably laying way more eggs than they would do naturally in the wild. So it's very painful for them. So you shouldn't be breeding them, exploiting them for that purpose. You should probably feed the eggs back to them to replenish the nutrients, which is what sanctuaries tend to do. I then at the end said, but look, like if you've got these chickens, you're not breeding them, and your principal reason for holding them is to look after them. It's not like your principal reason is eating the eggs and you happen to look after them. Your principal reason is looking after them. You feed their eggs back to them to replenish the nutrients. But it's also the case that you are just going to have some eggs that go spare, you know, because these eggs are going to be hatched. These eggs are going to be produced, and they're just going to be there, and you're already feeding the other eggs back to the chicken and whatever. Like, then yeah, I can't see why it would be wrong to eat them, right?
Interesting.
There's an argument to say that, sorry, did you say something?
Yeah, sorry. I have one question of clarification. Mm-hmm. Is you mentioned a moment of intention, which is your principal reason for having them. Is that actually important? Like, what if my principal reason is to get the eggs, but I fulfill all the other conditions from a consequentialist standpoint? I give them the eggs, I do all of that other stuff. Is the reason important?
It's wrong. Yeah, it's wrong for like second order reasons, which is to say, like, it's not kind of wrong in itself, so to speak. But if your intention is not the welfare of the animal primarily, then you're more likely to kind of accidentally, abuse that, or you're more likely to kind of miss when you're doing something that's harming them without realizing it. Right.
Got it.
If your primary intention is the care of the animal, then that's what's important. So what I said was that, like, so long as like, The only qualifier is that if you do eat that egg, you might be like normalizing the idea that it's okay to eat eggs. That might have an effect in terms of the image you're promoting or whatever. For indirect reasons, it might still be a bad idea to eat the egg. But the actual act of eating that egg is not immoral. Of course it's not, right? Mm-hmm. And I said this on a TikTok, and like, I was getting responses from people online saying, this guy isn't an ally of the animals. He's this disgusting animal exploiter, abuser. And I was looking at them thinking, my God, like, do you not understand that if our position isn't actually ethically consistent, nobody's going to take it seriously? Of course, there is nothing wrong if you're walking through the forest and, like, you know, like a pregnant cow was being fed on by its calf and the calf spat out some of the milk and it just happens to be laying on the floor and you scoop it up and shove it down your gullet. Of course, that's not immoral. Like, come on, like let's be real, you know? So yeah, to answer your question, like in those circumstances, like it's not wrong. The thing that's wrong isn't eating an animal product or eating an animal or eating a bit of meat. The thing that's wrong is causing the suffering. Right? Yep. It's not the act of eating the egg or even the act of eating the flesh. It's the process by which that was brought about. It's the fact that you have to kill an animal to bring it about. It's the fact that you have to cause suffering to an animal to get eggs from the egg industry. That's why you don't eat the eggs. It's not because eating the egg in and of itself is an immoral thing to do, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I think that what I'm going to noodle on, because this is fresh to me and I need time to sit on it, is should suffering, defined as you did, as a conscious experience of that, be my sole ethical coordinator, or am I justified and unable to articulate whatever else is in there? And even if it's not, is it still a good thing for me just to hold on to these like ghosts of ethical reasons that perhaps make me behave in a kinder way?
You just have to beware that anything that you do identify other than suffering that you think might be relevant, just make sure that it doesn't actually technically just break down to suffering, you know?
Yep.
Because that's one of the mistakes that people often make. They talk about like how, no, there are like, you know, I like to consider virtue. Mm-hmm. I like to consider, you know, rights, because rights seem to conflict with, consequentialism. Because, you know, if you have a right to life, then, you know, if it happens that it's going to cause less suffering to kill this person, like if you want to believe in rights, then consequentialism doesn't work. But you'll actually realize that maybe like the reason we have rights in the first place is ultimately to avoid suffering in the long run.
Yep.
Something like that. You have to make sure that it doesn't just break down suffering, because you might want to say, okay, I care about suffering and I care about human rights, but maybe human rights are actually just grounded in suffering in the first place, right?
Interesting.
So you've got to be careful that that's not what's happening.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is a good little moral pickle for me to.
I'm excited too. I'm going to look up what mammals don't attach to families. What mammals, if killed solo, have no family.
Or just go on walks in the woods looking for eggs.
I thought about like opening up a restaurant on the side of a busy road and just kind of waiting to find out what the special of the day was going to be.
There you go.
When the roadkill
special
is hit. You know, there are maybe ways around this. Yes. But I think that the key thing to take home is that, like, you know, is that final point that when we say eating meat is wrong, that's not what we mean. Eating meat is wrong is a proxy for saying causing unnecessary harm to an animal is wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, if every single animal in the world died right now instantly, such that there were going to be no more generations, because there can't be, because there's no one to breed them, like, and we were just left with a bunch of dead carcasses, would it be wrong to eat those carcasses? No, of course, it wouldn't be, because it wouldn't be harming any animals at that point. Mm-hmm. The product is already there.
Yep.
The reason you shouldn't eat it isn't just because it's a piece of meat. It's because by buying it, you're paying for this to continue.
Yep.
You're demanding economically that it happen again. That's what's wrong. The act itself is not what's wrong.
How do you think about, and this is just something that happens in where we grew up in the suburbs of Pennsylvania, there's this concept that for whatever reason, the way that humans have messed with the ecosystem, deer's natural predators are not around. And if deer are not hunted, their overpopulation will cause a lot of problems with the ecosystem, a lot of starvation for the deer. And so what happens in our area is it's, I believe, illegal to hunt deer except for 1 week or 1 or 2 weeks in the year, basically at the apex of whatever this overpopulation occurs. Hunting is allowed. I think there's a limit to how many deer are killed. And then it's illegal again, such that we are doing population control that should have been being done by wolves and coyotes, but we've just kind of killed them in the name of, you know, paving roads, making strip malls, creating suburban cul-de-sacs. So that's the justification of the practice, as far as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, have you ever heard of that, first of all, and do you have a thought around it?
I want to make sure I'm understanding the argument. Are you talking about kind of like hunting being beneficial to the ecosystem?
Well, this is specifically in our area. There's, yes, the sense that if you didn't do the hunt, then there would be overpopulation issues.
Yeah. You need all the grass, starve to death, then the other things, you need the grass.
Apparently, whoever makes the laws has come on board and said that this would be a big problem if we did allow this to happen. Mm-hmm. So hunt them for this limited time period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the first thing is a lot of these problems are human created in the first place. I mean, the ecosystem was doing fine before we kind of began meddling with this in this way. And so to say that like us refraining from continuing to meddle in it is problematic is a little strange. I mean, did you know, for instance, that there are, I think it's around 3,000, my number might be slightly wrong, but there are around 3,000 deer farms in the United States, which are breeding deer into existence for the purpose of being hunted. Like hunting, the idea that hunting is kind of motivated by provision of the ecosystem or preserving of the ecosystem is often, I think, not entirely accurate. There's also problems involving things like that, like predators naturally will eat the weak and the aged and the diseased animals, whereas hunters tend to go for the biggest and the strongest, you know, which actually kind of disrupts the process of evolution, because what we end up doing is like in nature, so to speak, you know, predators are killing the weak, which means that as the predators get faster, the prey gets faster, everything kind of evolving and balancing itself out. Mm-hmm. If we're going in and kind of shooting all of the big boys and kind of shooting them instead of shooting the diseased and the aged, then we're actually disrupting that flow such that now like we're going to cause more imbalance. I think we're actually causing more harm with the kind of hunting practices that we're using than we're actually contributing to the environment. I would recommend there's a great video that you can watch that condenses a lot of information specifically as regards to like ecosystem protection and hunting. It was made by my friend Ed Winters, who is Earthling Ed on YouTube. Mm. You probably know the guy. He made a video responding to Joe Rogan about this exact point, because Joe Rogan was talking all about the kind of things that you're talking about. And Ed essentially just dismantled the guy. And he does a much better job of that than I do or I would. I don't know what the situation is actually like in Pennsylvania. I'm not familiar with these laws, so I wouldn't be able to kind of speak authoritatively on them. What I would say is this, like, if it is genuinely true that it causes less suffering, right? Remember, a vegan is still responsible for animal suffering. When I eat plants, animals are suffering.
Yeah.
The reason I still eat them is because I say that by eating them, by essentially killing these animals to produce these plants and eating the plants, I'm causing less animal suffering in the long run. If it is genuinely true that by hunting these animals, it causes less animal suffering, then I think it would be the vegan thing to do.
Got it. Like,
it would be as simple as that.
I wouldn't
want to say something like, no, it's still wrong because of this reason or that reason or that reason. I'm just saying that like, I don't think it is actually true that it causes less suffering, but if it did, that would be a vegan thing to do.
So the main thing is to have some skepticism around the people who are giving you this information may not be coming from a pure philosophical place.
And
so you have to make sure that this is actually how the math works out and not just something being used to justify something they want to do. In the same way, you don't want a vegan to just start with, we can't eat animals. You don't want them to start with, let's justify hunting deer.
Yeah.
So you just have to make sure to the best of your ability that the math works out such that you're actually contributing to decreasing suffering.
Yeah, I just clicked on a document I had here to check that number. It's actually 4,000 deer farms in the United States where deer are artificially bred into existence. Mm. I'm also kind of looking at notes about like practices like there's a practice called clear cutting, in which state wildlife management agencies that will cut down large expanses of forest on public lands in order to create edge habitat that's favored by deer. In order to kind of have more deer so that hunters can go and hunt them. Like for every example you can give of like hunting benefiting the ecosystem, you can give as many and probably more examples of ways in which people are actually breeding these animals into existence. If we're worried about overpopulation, then why are we breeding them into existence for the purposes of hunting? Mm-hmm. It's also clear to me that like on a more trivial basis, this isn't what's motivating most hunters. Like people like to say when they go out and shoot an animal that they're doing it because they care about the environment. You know, like I've never seen a hunter on Facebook take a picture with his gun like next to a recycling bin, right? It's like that's not what they're actually motivated by. I'm sure if that was actually the principal concern, then we could have a very serious discussion about like, you know, whether hunting is actually a viable thing in certain situations. But we would have to recognize that it would be like a necessary evil. We would kind of be going into the wild and essentially seeing it as euthanizing these animals, killing these animals in the most painless way we possibly can and being very solemn and sad about it. We wouldn't be going and shooting them in the lung, taking a picture with them and saying, you know, F yeah on Facebook.
Like a dog shelter.
Yeah, it needs to be rethought.
Yeah.
So, well, I was thinking of the Maui venison people, because that is what they do.
But I think his point, which is that you would not place the moral core on intention. But what you're saying is if your intention is not pure, you are inevitably going to create suffering because you are being driven by other considerations and then backwards rationalizing why. So,
well, we assumed their intentions weren't pure.
We would have to know. We would have to know. And I'd be willing to bet that they would not shut down their business. You know what I mean? I don't think they're planning on going out of business. I don't think they're there to help the deer. Am I honest to God? I think they're looking for ways to get people meat. I don't think that's a crazy guess. So what we're talking about, just to catch you up, is that there's these people who hunt an invasive species, a company of deer in Hawaii, and they bill it as ethical meat. And we've really kicked this one around a lot. Oh, they shouldn't be there. But what I'm landing on, and we've talked to, is that they're not out there to euthanize deer. They're out there to sell beef cutlets and such.
Yeah, like you know, you can think of the business model. We're a bunch of people sitting around and saying, hey man, like I really want to help the wildlife. I know, let's start killing them and selling them to me. Or do they say, hey man, I really want to like, you know, sell meat, but you know, there are some ethical concerns. I know, let's, you know, frame it as an ethical version of euthanasia. But of course, like it isn't particularly relevant in that even if all wildlife agencies were actually motivated by like kind of evil ulterior motives or whatever it may be, like if it genuinely is actually helping, then, you know, the fact that their motivations are impure wouldn't change the fact that it would be like the right thing to be doing. What I would say, I mean, when you guys first reached out in the original email, it was kind of mentioned by name, this issue of like hunting and ecosystems and stuff. And I basically replied as I'm replying now, which is to say like, you know, I'm a philosopher, right? So I can say, if you give me a situation, I can tell you what I ethically think of it. What I can't really do is tell you whether that situation actually actually holds, right? Like I can't tell you whether or not the hunting situation in Pennsylvania is genuinely more harmful or more good. I would bet that it's more harmful from what I've seen elsewhere, but I couldn't say that with certainty. But what I can say is the ethical conditional statement that if it causes, if it actually minimizes suffering, then I think we should be doing it. But that's the question that needs to be answered. Is it genuinely doing what they're saying it's doing? And most of the time, you'll find that it's not.
We got to have the CEO of the Maui Venison Company on, man.
It'd be interesting.
We got to do it. Maybe we'll have you on too. Just let you guys talk while we listen.
Well, you know, I would, you know, maybe, although I would also say, like, I would stress that if you're interested in like the actual practicalities of this kind of stuff, of like ecosystems and hunting and the ethics of veganism, like I'm not your guy here. Earthling Ed is your guy on that stuff.
All right,
like that video that I mentioned in particular for your audience, if they're interested in this, I'd highly recommend going and listening to that. It's very well received even from like the pro hunting side, because they recognized it was a very intelligent argument to make. And anything that I would say would essentially be a less eloquent rehashing of that. But yeah, like ethically, my points stand. But if you're interested in those practicalities, I couldn't recommend his work enough.
Yeah. Well, awesome.
Dude, Earthling Ed and the CEO of, I'm serious. I want to hear him talk.
Well, Alex, thank you so much, man. I know your camera is probably dying, but I just want to say, give you a chance to talk about your own channel. But I've been watching on and off for a while. If any of our viewers like the philosophical stuff we do, Alex is doing it much more consistently and much more philosophically than we are. So if you want to check out his channel, it's Cosmic Skeptic. You've had a couple of really interesting, I guess, conversations with big names as well that are fascinating to break down. I think you do a great job there. So if any of our fans are interested, please, we'll put a link in the description. Go check them out. Anything else that you want to shout out about your channel or anything like that?
I have a Patreon.
Oh, there we go. Give him some money, baby.
That's very kind of you to say. I essentially started a podcast, but decided to make it infrequent and just put it on the main channel as and when things came up. So I've been really lucky to have some great conversations with some really interesting people. So yeah, people are interested in that. Check it out. There's nothing else I can really add, except that I'm now also on TikTok for some reason. Because I kind of had this account where I'm at Ask a Vegan, where I basically respond to people's questions about veganism. And one of these videos not long ago, for some reason, blew up and got like 2 million views. And it suddenly gave me a platform there. But I can't say I'd actually recommend going in and seeking that out, because TikTok is, you know, let's just say it's not the best place for rational discussions about the intricacies of the vegan ethic.
I'm shocked. I never would have guessed that TikTok comments would be the place. Well, Alex, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate you staying up late to talk to us.
You got it, guys. It's good fun.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.